They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again he took the 12 aside and told them that what was going to happen to him. "We are going to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" we asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup or drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right hand or left, it's not to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant about James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life as a ransom for many." Amen.
Thank you, David. Oh no, Lucy and I have been enjoying a little bit of Disney Plus recently, and one of the things that we really enjoyed was the remake of Aladdin. I'm sure you know the story. Aladdin finds a lamp, out pops a genie, and offers him 3 wishes. What would you wish for if you were Aladdin? It's a big question, isn't it? I've always wanted a house with turrets on. I know it's a bit of a strange wish, but it's one of those which I've always thought would be rather grand. But Aladdin's first wish, well, his first wish is to be made into a prince, and poof, there he is. He's turned into a prince. That's a little like the conversation that we eavesdrop on today between Jesus, James, and John. Jesus asks James and John, "What do you want me to do for you?" Here they have God's Son stood before them asking, "Well, what will it be? What do you want me to do for you?" It's a fascinating question, isn't it? If we could write a job description for Jesus, what would we write? If our prayers are anything to go by, well, we might have Jesus running the complaints department of heaven, ready to iron out all those little difficulties in life. We might have him working behind the scenes, pulling strings to grant success in exams, in interviews and cup finals. Or we'd have him acting as that on-call doctor for when we're sick. Or perhaps, maybe not, maybe your job description for Jesus would be very different. Perhaps your job description would be, "Just keep out of my way and keep yourself to yourself. Mind your own business." Well, today, we're going to see that Jesus' job description is much bigger than all of those things. So let's have a look at that as we look at how James and John answer. Looking in our first section, James and John's job description for Jesus. They are incredibly cheeky, aren't they? Consider, Jesus has just said that he's going to be handed over to death. He's going to be beaten, mocked, flogged, and spat upon. And James and John don't go up and say, "Oh, Jesus, we're so sorry to hear that. It won't be the same without you." No, in verse 32, they sidle up and say, 35, "Teacher, we want you to do whatever we ask." It comes across as incredibly arrogant and incredibly callous. Essentially, they're asking Jesus to sign a blank check. "Just sign this job description and we'll fill in the details for you afterwards." They're probably aware that their request is outrageous, but they think, well, if we can get Jesus to agree to it before we've told him what it is, then he won't be able to back out. Now, Jesus replies with astonishing patience. Not a rebuke, but a gentle willingness to engage, and maybe a wry smile on his face. "What do you want me to do for you?" They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." And now Jesus has just said that a brutal death awaits him at the end of this road. So it's a surprise, isn't it, to hear them say, "We want to sit at your right and your left in your glory." What's going on here is a really bad case of selective hearing. In the disciples' defense, they have now understood one thing. James and John were around when Peter declared Jesus to be the Christ. They were around on the Mount of Transfiguration where they saw Jesus in all his glory. And to their credit, they now understand that Jesus is the Messiah coming to reign and rule in Jerusalem. But then it's as if they've dozed off for the last three chapters or for the last 7 weeks in church. He's taught them over an extended period of time, maybe over about a year, they think, that his pathway to glory lies through intense suffering. What's more, he's taught that following him will also mean denying self and taking up your cross. But they seem to ignore that sort of bit and focus on the good stuff. "We want to share in your glory. One of us to sit at your right and at your left in your glory." You might remember when we looked at the book of Esther, the king asks Haman, "What should be done for the man that the king delights to honor?" And Haman instantly thinks, doesn't he, "Well, he must be talking about me. What should be done for me?" His three wishes are a royal robe, a royal horse, and a royal prince to parade him through the street and make a big deal about him. It's a similar idea here with James and John. They want glory. The seat that they're thinking of is a royal throne next to Jesus's, just like Aladdin. They want to be in charge. They want to be a prince. And they're not alone. See, the other disciples hear this and they're indignant with James and John. They're not offended that James and John say it, but they're offended that James and John say it first. "I can't believe they got in before we did. How dare they push us to the bottom of the table?" So the same continuation of the argument that they've been having in 9:34 about who was the greatest, who got to lord it over all the others. But that trait isn't limited just to Jesus' disciples. It was a wide character of the world around them. Verse 42, "You know that those who are regarded as the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." While the Romans had been in charge for 25 years now, and they'd ruled Judea with a heavy hand, the Emperor Tiberius himself cynically likens his own governors in that region to blood-sucking flies gorging themselves on a wounded man. Their leaders put themselves first and use the opportunity to feather their own nest at the expense of their followers. Serving self, leadership was the order of the day. And the disciples think, well, that's what we'd like. We'd like a slice of that action. And the way to get there? Well, they thought that Jesus was a train that they could ride to get there. Their job description for Jesus would be something along the lines of, well, you go and remove that Roman rule and be crowned in glory yourself, whilst we ride on your coattails and enjoy the bask in the reflected glory. That's not an uncommon idea when it comes to Jesus. One chap that I was reading about this last week says, how easily worship and discipleship become blended with self-interest. How easily worship and discipleship are blended with self-interest, or worse, self-interest is used as a mask for worship, is masked as worship and discipleship. Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. If we don't, well, we'll throw our toys out of the pram, or we'll just cease to follow you altogether. In many ways, it's a very revealing question, isn't it? If we were to honestly answer, really honestly answer, what do you want Jesus to do for you? Our answers might be a little less ambitious than the disciples, but still run along similar lines. Really, I just want Jesus to make my life comfortable and cozy, if not a little cushy. But the problem is that Jesus says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. If that's the disciples' job description for Jesus, notice Jesus has a very different job description for the disciples down there in verse 38. You do not know what you are asking, Jesus says. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with, but to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. Let's take that bit piece by piece. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? Jesus there is talking about his own impending suffering and death. A cup is a common enough metaphor in the Old Testament, used to signify something that's been allotted or apportioned by God. At times that cup would be full of joy and prosperity, but at other times it would be full of punishment and justice. More often than not, it's described as the cup of God's wrath. Likewise, with baptism, that's talking about God's punishment as well. Part of the picture of a baptism is death, dying to the old self beneath the waters of judgment, and then rising again to newness of life. So when Jesus is talking about his cup and his baptism, it's in reference to the painful ordeal that awaits him there in Jerusalem, which the disciples cannot be a part of, no matter how much they might say. You do not know what you're asking. Up until this point, it's just about possible to think that Jesus might die a glorious death, perhaps a warrior's death surrounded by piles of his enemies. And James and John, well, they think, oh, well, we might be willing to fight alongside him. But they've not quite understood, have they, just what Jesus' death is for, just how unique Jesus' death is going to be. It says in verse 45 that he's going to give his life as a ransom for many. And far from being able to participate in that, James and John are in dire need of that. All through this last section, the disciples have shown themselves to be no better than anyone else, just as sinful as those around them. But in another sense, you will drink the cup that I drink, and you will be baptized with the baptism that I will be baptized with, Jesus says. All through this section as well, Jesus has warned them that following him will be hard. At the end of the last section, last week, we heard that no one who's left home or brothers or sisters or mothers or fathers or children or fields for me or for the gospel will fail to receive 100 times more in the present age, homes, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, and fields, along with persecution, and in the age to come, eternal life. If we follow Jesus, we will suffer like Jesus. We won't suffer as Jesus suffers for the sins of humanity, but because the world hates Jesus, it will hate his followers, as indeed it did hate James and John. Both went on to suffer for Christ. In Acts chapter 12, it says that James was arrested by Herod and put to death with the sword. In Revelation, John introduces himself as a brother and a companion in suffering. He was exiled to work in the slave mines of Patmos. The rest of the 12 disciples died fairly brutal deaths. All of them drank from Jesus' cup in one way or another. One Christian poet wrote, "Can he have followed far who has no wound nor scar?" Suffering is an ordinary part of following Jesus. Jesus' job description for the disciples includes suffering, and secondly, it includes humble service. Verse 42, Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great amongst you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all." Two words to pick out there are servanthood and slavery, which we've come across again and again as we've been through Mark. But we get an earlier example of it with John the Baptist. At the very start of the Gospel, John the Baptist says, "After me comes one more powerful than I, the straps of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie." Now, in those days, untying someone's sandals or shoelaces was the lowest of the low. It was the least of the servants or the slaves that would have that task to perform. But John the Baptist, who Jesus declares to be the greatest man who has ever lived, says, "I'm not worthy even of that task. I'm not worthy of such recognition to undo Jesus' shoes." So on our children's camp this summer, we have some assistant leaders coming on who generally go around setting things up and cleaning things up and moving equipment around to the right places. And we do well to remind them at the start of the week that cleaning the toilets for Jesus is a privilege that they don't deserve. It might raise a few eyebrows if we did, didn't it? But that's what John the Baptist is saying here. The reality is that that servant attitude, that's the attitude that Jesus wants us to adopt. Whoever wants to be first must be the very slave of all. That's a different job description, isn't it, than the one that James and John were writing for themselves. Instead of the believer presenting Jesus with a blank check, a blank job description, and saying, "We'll fill it in for you," instead, the believer is to present Jesus with their own blank check and say, "Here I am, Lord. You do with me what you will. You write my job description for me." Not, "Lord, we want you to do for whatever we ask of you." But, "Lord, here are we to do whatever you ask of us." How does that sound to you this morning? It sounds hard. It sounds hard to me. Which is why verse 45 gives us such a powerful incentive. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And that could work in either of two ways. It could be that Jesus is a great example of this. If he did it, then so should we. Or it could be implying that if you are bought at, you are bought at a price, then you are under new management. When Israel were ransomed out of Egypt, they weren't just told to go off and do their own thing afterwards, were they? They were ransomed out of Egypt and so now belong to God as his treasured possession. And then he goes and tells them how to live. God gets to say how they live. They owe their complete allegiance to him. And so by implication, if the Son of Man has ransomed you, then you belong to him as his lawful servant, which ought to result in a huge shift in thinking. God doesn't exist to serve me. I exist to serve God, which was always the case, wasn't it? But that's doubly so if we were ransomed by Jesus. Jesus' job description for his disciples involves suffering and service. But he doesn't expect us to do what he hasn't done himself. Because God's job description for Jesus involved far greater suffering and service. Jesus' job description was, in fact, written a long time before he arrived. The latter chapters of Isaiah spend their time looking for a servant who is going to come, the servant of the Lord. In Isaiah 50, we find a description of what this servant is going to do and what he's going to be like when he arrives. Isaiah chapter 50, verse 5 says, "The sovereign Lord has opened my eyes. I have not been rebellious. I have not turned away. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting." Mocking, spitting, flogging, very similar to what Jesus says, awaits him. "Because the sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore have I set my face like flint, and I know I will not be put to shame." Flint is a particularly hard and inflexible rock, and the servant is going to be like that. Once he's chosen his path, there is no deviating from it. And that's what we see with Jesus. Isn't it astonishing? Jesus knows what lies ahead of him at the end of this road, and yet he marches on. Verse 32, "They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way." He isn't dragging his heels, as I would if I knew that I was going to be beaten, mocked, flogged, and spat upon. I would be marching the other way, but not Jesus. God has given him a job to do, and he humbly accepts it as a servant would. See how humbly he defers to God and his plan in verse 40. "But to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." You'd think, wouldn't you, that Jesus would get to pick who sits at his right and who sits at his left. But he doesn't. He'll happily submit to his Father's will. He is obedient servant to the very end. Verse 32. "Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. 'We are going up to Jerusalem,' he said. 'And the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise.'" And now, as I say, up until this point, it's just about possible to think that Jesus might have died a glorious death in battle, or even perhaps a noble death as a martyr. But these verses just rid us of that illusion, don't they? Jesus is in fact going to die a shameful death, a criminal's death, a sinner's death, treated as lower than the lowest of the low, executed as a common criminal, a job description he accepts not because he delights in it, but because he delights to serve his Father, and because he delights in its purpose. Verse 45, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. We mentioned last week that a ransom is just the price paid to set a prisoner free. But that price for Jesus involves drinking from the cup of God's wrath. Now, at university, one of the clubs that I used to be part of used to celebrate birthdays with a dirty pint. Essentially, what happened was a cup was passed around and people put money in it, and that money was used to fill it up with all kinds of potent things from behind the bar, beers, wines, spirits, and other less sanitary liquids as well. And the birthday boy or girl would have to drink it down to the very last dregs. Invariably, it led to vomiting, hangovers, and even food poisoning, I think. I lived in such fear that I actually hid my birthday for university and a good few years afterwards. But that's the kind of cup that we face from God. Not the cup of kindness, but the cup of his wrath. The punishment for all we've ever done, the punishment for all we've ever omitted to do, gathered together into one bitter cup for us to down. The cup of his wrath, which causes staggering. But Jesus' job description is to take that cup from our hands and to drink it down to the very last drop, so that every last bitter drop has been poured out, so that when that cup, when our birthday does come round, when that cup comes round to us, it's empty. Or rather, it's been refilled as the cup of joy and peace, as that we can walk free again. Jesus' death has ransomed many. The language from many there is lifted directly out of Isaiah 53. By his knowledge thou shalt my righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. The servant's job description has a purpose to it, that many should be accounted righteous. And the good news is that Jesus took that job description very seriously. He carried it out to the very last letter. As it says, as Jesus says in Hebrews, here I am, it is written about me in the scroll. I have come to do your will, God. Or even in Gethsemane, Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. So when it comes to asking Jesus, what do you want Jesus to do for you? Seems a little churlish, doesn't it, to ask for a house with turrets on when he has so much more to offer for us, when he offers us his life, when he offers us his righteousness. And if Jesus has fulfilled his job description, then it's for us, those who've been ransomed by him, to fulfill our job description. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the very slave of all. What will that mean for us? Well, it's wonderful to see it working out all the way through Park Street. We're surrounded by plenty of good examples of this. I think of folks helping out with the youth on a Friday, not because it's their forte, not because they enjoy running around castles on a Friday at night, but because they saw a need and they want those children to hear about Jesus. I think of folks doing a great deal of organizing behind the scenes, not because it brings them glory, so that the church will run smoothly, so that we can enjoy things like communion together. I think of folks caring for others, both day and night, because that is how the Lord has cared for them. I think of the music group rehearsing songs that they wouldn't pick for themselves, so that we can, laying aside personal preference, so that others can sing with gusto in a morning. I think of those foregoing the pleasures of catching up with friends on a Sunday morning so that they have the opportunity to get to know someone new as they walk through the doors. This and many, many other things only happen because people have really understood not only is Jesus a ransom for many, but Jesus is a ransom for me.